headlines, Iran and Venezuela forging their strategic bonds with a 20-year cooperation deal as President Maduro visits Tehran. Ukraine's military says it urgently needs Western weaponry to ward off Russian attacks in the east. Also coming up in this newscast, U.S. stocks taking a nosedive after inflation accelerates to a 40-year high. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro is on an official visit to Iran. Maduro and his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi, have signed a document for a 20-year cooperation plan between the two countries. The two presidents have stressed closer mutual cooperation on all fronts. They said Tehran and Caracas should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, and science and technology. Raisi and Maduro hailed the establishment of a direct Tehran-Caracas flight as an opportunity to enhance bilateral relations and bring the two nations closer. President Raisi also hailed Venezuela for standing up to foreign pressure and imperialism. Venezuelan president arrived in Tehran on Friday for a two-day visit. Sayed Mustafa Khoshchesh, political analyst, is joining us live from Tehran, and also Barry Grossman is with us, international lawyer and political analyst from Bali, to discuss that further. Let's begin with Mr. Khoshchesh. Mr. Khoshchesh, in your opinion, Maduro has talked about how Iran and Venezuela are contributing to building a world of free of a world actually free of domineering and imperialism. Tell us about how significant a role these countries can play in transforming the global geopolitical system.
Well, thanks for having me. Well, both Iran and Venezuela are oil-producing countries under the U.S. sanctions. That produces a lot of potential for developing strategic cooperation between the two sides in various areas of politics, economy, culture, and, defense areas as well, especially when it comes to international cooperation. We do remember that a couple of years ago when the Venezuelan refineries and power station came under cyber attack by the United States to increase public dissent, to take people out to the streets against Maduro and to overthrow the government of Maduro. Then Iran rushed to Maduro's help and the Venezuelan people's help. The people were queuing lines, waiting to fill their tanks, car tanks. Iran sent a dozen tankers, not only taking petrol to Venezuela, but also spare parts for refineries, engineers, technology, and everything, as well as additives and, to help the country come back online, bring their refineries back online. And that soothed, actually, the crisis in the country and defused the U.S. plans for overthrowing the government in there. So the two are also major oil-producing countries and could help each other with, managing the global oil market as we are approaching winter and then the energy prices are rising because of the Ukraine war, and the U.S. needs much of, energy imports as well as the Europeans. And they need energy, and the only two countries that might increase supplies in the market and have reserves are Venezuela and Iran. So they could play a major role in coming months with regard to energy market. And the two also have the potential to help each other with regard to their economies. They could play complementary roles. Iran is a major producer of fertilizers, agro-machineries, as well as passenger cars, especially for the lower end of the market. And Venezuela needs all of these products. So Iran could boost its, exports to the country. And also in area of defense, also Iran has very effective military weapon systems that could, you know, increase and enhance Venezuela's defense power and military power on the coasts of the Caribbean. So the two have a lot to share, and that they could turn into strategic partners soon in future. We will witness this expansion of ties, especially when President Raisi and his revolutionary government came to power, whose foreign policy is developing ties with those nations that are outside the U.S. Domain of power or hegemonic rule. And Venezuela is one of the best countries that could be the base for expansion of ties between Latin America and Iran. And the two rely on each other very much and trust each other very much. So I believe this is just the beginning of a jump in the expansion of ties between Iran, not just with and Venezuela, but also Iran and Latin America.
Okay, so Mr. Grossman, now let's talk about the timing of this visit. Just days after the U.S. barred Venezuela and two other Latin American states from the Americas summit, we see Maduro in Tehran and the two countries laying out a 20-year cooperation map. Or should we see this in light of a united front against the U.S. Domination growing stronger?
Well, it certainly does represent something of a united front in the sense that both Iran and Venezuela are properly considered resistance economies. And the timing of it obviously is meant to coincide with the absurd decision by the U.S. to exclude Venezuela from the meeting of American nations that's being held under U.S. auspices. But if we look at the larger picture, there's nothing surprising about this. Iran certainly has been a very good friend to Venezuela. Both countries are heavily targeted by sanctions, heavily targeted for regime change, as the Americans like to call it, when they're being honest. Both countries are significant oil producers. And of course, as President Maduro acknowledged, Iran has really been very helpful to Venezuela, as Venezuela has been compelled to deal with the obstacles put in its place by the U.S. Having said that, while it's always good to see resistance economies coming together, I can't help but think that in many ways Venezuela is in a much more precarious position, in the sense that the U.S. is very active in trying to achieve regime change, and really the only thing that stands between a substantial change in policy in Venezuela is Maduro and Maduro's party. And if they are gone, of course, the opposition present a very different front, whereas my own view is that whatever the U.S. does, whatever Atlantic world countries do, they have virtually no chance of achieving anything that could be properly considered regime change in Iran. That is to say, Iran is an Islamic republic, having gone through an Islamic revolution. While it shares a lot in common in terms of policy and concerns with social justice with Venezuela, the basis for those concerns are very different. In Iran, the basis for these concerns is, of course, Islamic. In Venezuela, it's ideological. It makes perfectly good sense that they should cooperate, happy to see it. But this is a relationship which probably benefits Venezuela a whole lot more than Iran. Having said that, in the fullness of time, anything is possible. We all hope, live and pray for the day when U.S. hegemony will be stopped in its tracks and Atlantic world countries will start to recognize the sovereignty of other nations and the right of other nations to govern their internal domestic affairs as they see fit, and of course to have a foreign policy.
Thank you very much, said Mustafa Khoshchesh, political analyst, joining us live from Tehran, and also from Bali, Mr. Barry Grossman, a lawyer and political analyst. Iran is calling for an immediate and effective action by the international community to end the unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. on the country. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations says the coercive measures have negatively affected the country's health system. Zahra Ershadi told a meeting of the UN General Assembly on AIDS that the sanctions have seriously violated Iran's rights to access health care, especially for those who are suffering from AIDS. Ershadi said the unilateral measures have hindered patients' timely and effective access to medicine and medical equipment. The U.S. reimposed its unilateral sanctions on Iran in 2018. The measures block Iran's access to financial channels, effectively preventing the country from making any payment for purchased goods. Iran condemns the latest Israeli missile strike on the Syrian capital, Damascus, vowing to stand by the country's government and people. Iran's foreign minister says the Israeli attacks against Syrian infrastructure are illegal under international law and violate its sovereignty. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also says the regional and international silence on the attacks are shameful. He made the comments in a phone call with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal Maqdad. Also, he said that Israel's hasty acts of aggression are a sign of its fear and weakness. Maqdad said the regime is vainly trying to prop up remnants of the terrorist groups in Syria. The latest Israeli airstrike early on Friday caused heavy damage to airstrips at the Damascus International Airport. Our flights are currently suspended. Syria says civil aviation personnel are working to fix the problem and restore the flights. For the second day in a row, members of the anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen Khalq organization have tried to sabotage an exhibition in the Swedish capital displaying their crimes. Bianca Rahimi was there.
Members of the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist group, also known as the MKO, gathered in the Swedish capital on Friday for the second day in a row to sabotage an exhibition on the group's crimes. The Swedish police struggled to control the situation, with MKO members spreading out, running down the streets away from the place designated for the protest and harassing Press TV's reporters and camera crew. On Thursday, several members of the MKO were arrested for attacking the exhibition and throwing objects, including paint, at the exhibition and public property. The organizer of the expo, the Harbilion NGO, say the police tried to sabotage the event by refusing to allow banners to be put up and denying journalists adequate security, despite them having the necessary permits. The MKO has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Its members fled Iran in 1986 to Iraq, where they enjoyed backing from former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. MKO terrorists enjoy freedom of activity and movement in the US and Europe, and even hold regular meetings in which European and American officials make speeches.
The organizers of this event say that the MKO has protested in the Swedish capital for 90 days straight with government security. This suggests that this organization feels safe and protected here in Sweden. Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
Ukraine asking the West for more weapons as Russia steps up attacks in the east more than 3 months into the war there. Ukrainian military officials say they are outgunned by the more powerful Russian army. They say they need more advanced Western weapons, including rocket systems, to fend off Russian artillery attacks. Moscow has been focusing its firepower in the eastern Donbass region over the past few weeks, with the fiercest battles taking place in the Severodonetsk, in an industrial city of Luhansk province. Ukrainians have largely pulled out of the city's residential areas, but they are still putting up resistance against Russian advance from the north and the south. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is actually trying to break every town in Donbass. The fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war continues to take heavy tolls on the U.S. economy. U.S. stocks fall sharply as the country's inflation surges to a new four-decade high record. The New York Stock Exchange saw Dow Jones Industrial Average, the broad-based S&P 500, and the tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index all tumble. It came after the Labor Department said the Consumer Price Index surged by 8.6% in May compared to the same period last year, which is unseen since 1981. This figure exceeded all forecasts. This comes as gasoline prices are hitting records every day in the U.S. as the war in Ukraine drags on. Prices continue to rise last month for a range of other goods, including housing, groceries, and airline fares, as well as other vehicles. Iranians have gathered in Tehran to mark the auspicious occasion of the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the 8th infallible Imam of the Shia household. Iranians seized the opportunity to condemn France for awarding a movie which insulted Imam Reza during the Cannes Film Festival almost 10 days ago. Salman Khujuri reports.
Thousands of Iranian Muslims have come together in capital Tehran to celebrate the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the 8th infallible Shia Imam. People from different walks of life took part in the ceremony to pay respect to the lofty status of Imam Reza, who is considered by Iranians as a symbol of divine love and affection.
I'm here to say that we love Imam Reza from the bottom of our hearts. I have raised my children with a love for Imam Reza. We are ready to die for him, and we will continue his path.
The ceremony comes almost 10 days after France awarded a movie titled Holy Spider during the Cannes Film Festival, which Muslims believed insulted Islamic sanctities.
Iranian officials believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider is insulting and politically motivated and is the product of the confused mind of a Danish-Iranian filmmaker, sponsored and financed by global arrogance.
People strongly condemn the move by France, saying such a sacrilegious act will never be forgotten.
I want to send this message to the enemies that the light of the sun will never fade away. So the name and the path of Imam Reza will remain forever, and the enemy's plots will never bear any results.
I believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider has been totally politically motivated, and it was an open insult to Islamic sanctities. We condemn such a movie, and we condemn such a sacrilegious act against Islam.
The participants believe that the large gathering of Muslim believers has sent this message to the enemies of Islam, that Muslims will never remain silent and indifferent towards any insult against their sanctities, and they are ready to defend their Islamic values and beliefs until the last drop of their blood. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. least 16 recipients of the European Research Council ERC grants making plans to reject UK offer and move their laboratories abroad, as the United Kingdom remains frozen out of the European Union's flagship science programme. We now present you an article written by Hannah Devlin. The piece is titled "Brexit Row Could Prompt Exodus of Senior Scientists from UK." The United Kingdom is facing an exodus of star scientists, with at least 16 recipients of prestigious European grants making plans to move their laboratories abroad, as the UK remains frozen out of the European Union's flagship science programme. Britain's participation in Horizon Europe has been caught in crosshairs of the dispute over Brexit in Northern Ireland, meaning that 143 UK-based recipients of European Research Council fellowships recently faced a deadline of either relinquishing their grant or transferring it to an institute in an eligible country. The British government has promised to underwrite the funding, totalling about £250 million, but a growing number of scientists appear likely to reject the offer and instead relocate, along with entire teams of researchers. The European Research Council, ERC, said 16 academics had recently informed it that they intend to move their laboratories abroad or are in negotiations about doing so. These researchers and some others have been given an extension before their grants are terminated. Moritz Treek, a group leader at the Francis Crick Institute in London, who is due to receive €2 million over 5 years from the European Research Council, ERC, to study the malaria pathogen, is among those contemplating a move. Maurice Trigg said, "A major downside of the UK offer was the lack of flexibility about moving the funding internationally." He said, "It personally makes me very angry. The UK Research Institute really put up a wall for scientists to move the funding. It's all nationalist stuff. It's not about science." The Guardian heard from three other senior academics planning to move, who wished to remain anonymous because they were negotiating contracts. One, a biology professor at a top-ranking university, awarded a €2 million grant, said the impasse over Britain's participation in European Union programmes had already been hugely disruptive. She said, "I feel heartbroken to be put into this position." She added, "Either I leave at huge personal and professional cost, or I stay and miss out on career-changing opportunities. This was supposed to be a massive achievement and recognition of our standing as scientists. Instead, I feel hugely stressed." Another said the offer to match the €2 million funding she had been awarded to research the roots of populism in the 21st century would not replace the prestige of European Research Council grants, widely viewed as the Champions League of academic fellowships. She said, "European Research Council, ERC, is a label that is internationally recognised as excellence. For me, as a Latin American immigrant, it's really something that changes my career in Europe. I worked on this proposal for 2 years, and I didn't want to give up something that I really struggled to get." A third senior scientist who plans to transfer a €2 million ERC grant to study the response of animals to climate change to an institute outside of Britain said, "My main motivator for choosing to move is that I lack trust in UK governmental institutions and processes after what I've witnessed since moving here. The loss of these academics is a blow to the British government's proposed bold global alternative to Horizon. Recently, the science minister, George Freeman, called on the European Union not to weaponize science for politics before a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, but said the United Kingdom was ready to press ahead with its Plan B if the dispute is not resolved. Others who are remaining in the United Kingdom said they had been left in limbo, with little clarity on when the UK Research Institute funding will be available. Professor Ben Sheldon, an ecologist at the University of Oxford, who was awarded a €3.1 million grant to study the effect of human-caused climate change in the timing of seasonal events in Oxford's Witham Woods, said, "We've heard nothing at all, which is one of the disturbing things. It's like a black hole." Professor Ben Sheldon said the uncertainty about funding meant he could not start recruiting the four PhD students, four postdoctoral graduates and technicians needed for the project, and since the research focused on seasonal phenomena, this could delay the work by up to a year. He said, "These are major research programs. You can't just recruit people to start the next day," adding, "It's hugely destabilizing." A spokesperson for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "Successful awardees do not need to leave the United Kingdom to receive funding," adding, "We recognize the European Union's delays to formalizing the UK's association to Horizon Europe have led to uncertainty for researchers, for businesses and innovators based in the United Kingdom." The spokesperson for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "This is why the government has guaranteed funding for eligible successful applicants to Horizon Europe, who are expected to sign grant agreements by December of 2022, and who have been unable to sign grant agreements with the European Union. This includes European Research Council winners, claiming, "The guarantee means that eligible successful applicants will receive the full value of their funding at their UK host institution for the lifetime of their grant." Moreover, it has emerged that British universities are facing a brain drain as a row over Brexit in Northern Ireland threatens £250 million in research funding from the European Union. The European Research Council, ERC, has written to 98 scientists and academics who were recently approved for €172 million in grants, telling them that if the UK's associate membership of the €80 billion Horizon Europe programme is not ratified, they will not be eligible to draw down the money. Scientists have said they're now scrambling to find alternative EU institutions to host the funding, and some already turning down the European Research Council money and hoping the British government's promise of replacement cash will be delivered. But they say in either case it is devastating, as the European Research Council is considered one of the most prestigious programmes in the world. The then Brexit Secretary David Frost fought hard to get associate membership of Horizon Europe as part of the trade deal negotiations in 2020, but ratification has been delayed while Britain fails to implement the Northern Ireland Protocol. British scientists say they are being punished. Payam Gamage, a scientist at the Beatson Institute at Glasgow University, said, "It's a strange choice for the European Union. The United Kingdom isn't going to notice it immediately. It will take a long time to have any impact. All that happens is a bunch of scientists have a lot of opportunities taken away or their lives just made a lot more difficult. We're the only victims." Gamage was awarded a €2 million award to expand research on mitochondrial genetics and mutations in tumours, but has decided to turn down the European Research Council grant and apply for replacement funding from the UK Research and Innovation Fund. He said this was not the same as there was no detail about the terms and conditions of funding. Gamet said the idea that Britain could replicate the system and apparatus of something like the European Research Council in the near to medium term is at best unrealistic. Seymour Fetzer, a professor of economics at Warwick University, who was approved for €1.5 million funding, said, "We all had reason to believe that the UK Association was just a matter of the UK implementing the free trade agreement. Now we're waking up to the reality. It is very devastating." A molecular biologist who was awarded a €2 million fund for a 5-year research programme said she would now be looking to commute to Ireland or to Belgium. She said, "My main priority is getting the funding because an award at this level of funding happens once in a lifetime." Starter grants are worth €1.5 million each, and consolidator grants are worth up to €2 million each, with a further round of advanced grants due to the awarded next month, worth up to €2.5 million each, which could take the overall UK funding to about €300 million. Britain's Science Minister George Freeman has pledged to extend the guaranteed replacement funding until December of 2022. The president of the European Research Council, Professor Maria Leptin, said she was fervently hoping that the UK-EU negotiations would be finalised and result in association with Horizon Europe. She said, "Our letters to grantees had to point out the option for portability of the grant outside of the United Kingdom, but nobody here has any wish at all to entice anyone to leave the UK."
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. On Wednesday, the IAEA Board of Governors passed a resolution against Iran accusing Tehran of not cooperating with the UN nuclear watchdog. Iran has responded to the move by beginning to inject uranium gas into advanced centrifuges and disconnecting some IAEA cameras monitoring its sites outside the safeguards agreement. And now France, Britain, and Germany have condemned steps taken by Iran, saying the move has cast a doubt on Tehran's will to revive the JCPOA. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll try to take a closer look at the recent anti-Iran resolution and Tehran's response, as well as the Europeans' Troika statement. On this edition of Spotlight, we have... Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us from Islamabad. And political commentator Frank Emspach, joining us from Boston.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Sayed Mohsen Abbas in Islamabad. Cooperation between Iran and the IAEA has taken a turn for the worse following the recent anti-Iran resolution. Given Iran's previous cooperation with the IAEA, does Iran have every reason to be outraged by the IAEA's accusation of lack of cooperation from Tehran?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, it's totally against the norms of any kind of, fair-minded or just approach by an institution, an internationally recognized institution like the IAEA, to be going around running in Israel, which is, a diametrically opposed force to the Islamic Republic in the region. So that was really very, very improper, to say the very least. And so the Iranians have got every right to be dismayed at that action in itself. But of course, what Europe and what America have been doing from day dot, since the day they signed originally this JCPOA agreement, is they've been flagrantly violating it. I don't think there's been any stage where these particular signatories to the JCPOA have actually done anything to abide by even that agreement which they signed. So the Europeans are not really much better than the Americans. The Americans walked out under Trump, which was, you know, absolutely mind-boggling the way they did that without any discussion whatsoever. That was ridiculous enough. But then the Europeans went into this song and dance about creating INSTEX and creating means of being able to help Iran to trade in the meantime without all these sanctions that were imposed, but that came to really nothing. There was just all talk. So Europe and the European signatories to this document have proved themselves to be essentially a paper tiger, and worse still, really just the tail of a tiger, to be honest. And the Americans have proved that they have no decisive leadership around this issue. They dropped the issue really at the moment, which is blocking the whole idea of the agreement, is really that they aren't willing to drop the IRGC from the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Again, the first time I've ever heard of a military being condemned as a terror organization. But anyway, they did it. Trump did it. Biden hasn't backed off from it. And the compromise that was actually behind the scenes mooted was that the IRGC should be delisted and the Quds force actually wouldn't. So Iran's kind of foreign force would remain on that list. But Biden is so weak and so scared of the Zionist lobby, he's not even attempted to try and come to some sort of compromise around this. And so one can only say that the actions of Trump and his withdrawal were reckless, but the actions of Biden and the current regime and the Europeans are really just equally feckless and reckless as well. The result is that the maximum pressure which Mr. Trump instituted and which Mr. Biden has continued with glee have had no effect, and they are failing. They will fail. They'll sure continue to strengthen Iran. So really, it's a failure in statecraft on the part of the Europeans and the Americans.
Frank Emspach in Boston, Iran's nuclear chief, has warned that Iran's response to the resolution will be, quote, firm and proportionate. As we know, Iran has already taken retaliatory measures, including installation of advanced centrifuges and turning off some of the agency's surveillance cameras. Iran has informed the IAEA of its plans to remove all extra surveillance cameras installed under the 2015 deal, cameras that were there as a goodwill gesture beyond the safeguards agreement. In your opinion, are these moves justified now?
Well, I think they've been justified in a certain sense for a long time. The United States unilaterally withdrew from this agreement. The Europeans said, we'll support the agreement. We signed it. And then they didn't do it. So the Iranians were left out in the cold economically and politically. Their leadership had bet a lot on the agreement. Meanwhile, Israel and others are working to undermine it. And the IEA has done nothing to deal with Israeli nuclear weapons. So you have this situation where the Western countries, the Europeans, have lost all credibility. But let's put this also in another context. Today, there is a meeting of South American and Central American countries under the leadership of the United States in Los Angeles. And Venezuela is not there. They were not invited. And as a result of that, Mexico and others pulled out. Venezuela, as I understand it, is now in Iran. The president is in Iran. And so what we're having here is a challenge to the United States' hegemony in diplomatic affairs. And, of course, an economic challenge, because what has happened here is that Iran has survived. It has been able to sell oil. It is working with the Chinese. The Russians and the Chinese, for instance, did not agree with the IEA. So there is a shift going on here. And the sanctions that the United States has been using are showing a degree of ineffectiveness. Not that they're totally ineffective. It certainly hurt people. But they're not accomplishing what the U.S. wanted. Meanwhile, internally to this country, there is no major force within the Democratic Party, which is the ruling party at the moment, fighting for this treaty. There are certain individuals and there are certain leaders, but overall, Biden has backed away from this, and I think the commentator prior to me was correct, out of fear that he will be charged by the Republicans with somehow losing Iran or being appeasing the Iranians or whatever, and thereby weakened even further. So it's a very dangerous situation, particularly also today. The papers announced that the Israelis were meeting with the Saudis about security issues, whatever that means, but it probably means Iran being targeted. So it's a very, very dangerous situation, it seems to me.
Said Mohsen Abbas, the Iranian nuclear chief has sharply criticized the IAEA agents, the International Atomic Energy Agency, warning that the IAEA is caught in the clutches of Zionists. Now, given Rafael Grossi's visit to Israel prior to the meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors, would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I think anybody who has any real in-depth analysis about the way the international order or the world is set up will understand very much that it's a combination of the Atlantic powers and the states and their economic, backing, added to transnational corporate power and their financial backing, which actually keeps these kinds of institutions like the IAEA or the WHO or any of these other huge kind of international level organizations, the United Nations, various others, you know, and once you have finances coming from a particular source backing supposedly neutral, benign institutions that are meant to try and solve problems or keep an eye on trouble and really protect the world from Armageddon, in the case of IAEA, you find that there's actually a sort of compromise and a sort of a clash of interests and a compromise in the actual authenticity and honesty and integrity of these institutions. The IAEA is no different. They have been seen constantly to compromise their role. The most obvious one is that, for instance, they don't check up on the Saudi Arabian development of nuclear weapons, which is being fully pushed and supported by the Americans. Several companies that have even tendered bids to go into Saudi Arabia and to start developing their nuclear power. Now, again, Saudi Arabia is another primary antagonist of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So why the JCPOA and why such scrutiny on Iran when actually on the other side, the IAEA knows full well that the Saudis are being pushed towards nuclear arms and development as well. Israel is the other obvious case, you know, since it's had nuclear weapons and since everybody knows that the biggest open secret, Mr. Vananu blew it open back in the day. But since then, where is the IAEA in pushing Israel to join the non-proliferation treaty? Where is the IAEA in its demands to go and check out the Dimona nuclear sites in Israel? Do they have any monitoring? No, they don't. So there you see, just with two examples, you can see that there are double standards and this hypocrisy, which, you know, stinks to high heaven. And there is a serious threat of, of global confrontation and conflict and real Armageddon because of this bias. This is the problem, that the more that organizations like the IAEA kowtow to the Americans, kowtow to the Israelis with exceptionalism, and at the same time act in a belligerent way to the likes of Iran, the more chance there is of war.
Mr. Ansbach, I want to get your perspective on that issue. Why was the IAEA chief in Israel? Why the Israeli regime itself is a violator of the IAEA's rules?
Well, I can't speak for the IAEA, but I can speak when we look at the role of the United States here. The United States is the prime economic financier of Israel for a whole variety of different reasons. And the United States has been quite clear that it will veto or prevent in any forum, at any level, any investigation of Israeli nuclear availability or possibilities. So the IAEA falls within that. You know, one maneuver or another within the IAEA prevents it from going forward. And the inability or the unwillingness of the Europeans to declare independence from the United States in this regard simply reinforces the situation. And I think, again, it's a very dangerous situation. We, the United States government, within this country, there is not a political force of significance that can take on the Israeli lobby and the Zionist position here. And I think although that is changing somewhat, it is by nowhere near a strong enough current to force changes in American foreign policy. And so until that happens, the United States, as the main financier of Israel, never mind the subsidiary agencies in the United Nations, is simply not going to permit the IAEA to do anything. And I think that's clear. However they do it, it's not important, but that is the end result.
Said Mohsen Abbas, you mentioned Europe a little earlier, but let's really focus on Europe's role. The E3, that's Britain, France, and Germany, all parties to the 2015 Iran deal. They say Iran's actions cast doubt on its commitments to revive the nuclear deal. What about all of Europe's shortcomings in the implementation of the JCPOA in the first place?
Well, exactly. The sad conclusion is really that the EU, despite its promises and all its kind of supposed goodwill, it was unable to negate the punitive US actions at all. And again, the EU has failed to achieve anything spectacular, even through the Joint Comprehensive Action Plan, as it was laid out. I mean, it was meant to be, let's not forget, a flagship foreign policy achievement of the EU and a common foreign policy. And it was a symbol of the organization's growing strength, apparently. And in fact, what's really come out is that the EU is still just a paper tiger. It has no military force on the ground. It's a lackey of America in NATO. Even in the so-called aggression by the Russians, it's actually the Americans who've pushed the EU into a situation where, again, they're the ones who are getting hit by all the oil and the potential economic disaster, while the Americans are using them there as well. And the same goes here, that there's no real a benefit for the EU in terms of sanctioning Iran. In fact, companies like Total and many others were in there beginning to build relationships with Iran, which is a huge economy. I mean, the Iranians, let's not forget, have just signed a £600 million deal with China and strengthening the Eurasian bloc, which is going to become the major, if you like, economic challenge for European and Western economic hegemony, if you like. So you would have thought that the EU would have been thinking about at least trying to break up the Eurasian alliance, or at least getting a piece of the pie. Nothing doing. They're too scared that if they did anything in Iran, essentially all their trade with America and all the restrictions and control excuse me, would cost the corporate companies hugely, and also cost Europe as a group of nations. So they're too scared to take on America at the moment, and I'm afraid that they've really just relinquished all sense of justice, and they've weighed in with the Americans and have just played the good cop, which actually is really totally on America's side. And the result of it, in conclusion, I'd just like to say that basically, you know, the economic deprivation has only hit the Iranian people, not the establishment. So first of all, your maximum pressure, which the Europeans fell in line with America, hasn't really stopped Iran being whatever, you know, they objected to in the first place. The Europeans, God knows what that is, but they have an objection with the actual whole political system and the governance as it stands. And they interfere regularly, creating color revolutions to that end. And the Europeans are involved in this, sure, as well. The fissile material, they say themselves now that Iran, because of all this nonsense they've done around the JCPOA, Iran is capable of producing fissile material that could produce a nuclear weapon. Ayatollah Khamenei has said over and over again that on a spiritual, religious and moral, ethical basis, Iran does not want to make weapons. That means something in Iran when the Imam Khamenei says that. But of course, now the Iranians definitely have the ability. They want to use that ability for peaceful means. They say that.
Okay.
And there are incentives for them to do that if the JCPOA and trade, et cetera, was opened up. But the way that the Europeans and the Americans have played it, all they've done is made the whole region more dangerous. They've allowed this sparring to start take place between Israel and Iran, and it's actually pushed everything to a much more volatile and potentially warlike footing.
Frank M. Spack, Britain, France, and Germany presented this anti-Iran resolution to the IAEA. Iran's foreign minister says that such behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal. Do you believe the E3 countries were again following the U.S.'s lead by conjuring and presenting the anti-Iran resolution to the IAEA? As we know, the independence of Europe regarding Iran's nuclear deal has always been a subject of speculation.
Well, I'm not sure that the United States called them up and said, hey, let's this week. I think in each of those societies, there was significant opposition to the treaty in the first place. I think what's happening here, though, is that within each of those societies, the real role of the progressive parties or the social democratic parties or the more liberal organizations is really in question here, because they're unable, apparently, to control the dialogue, because all of these parties have said they favor the treaty. And so it appears that they're not really able to control the discussion or to insist that their governments live up to the treaty. And I think that mirrors the situation in the United States, where within the Democratic Party, there are some people who support the boycott, divest movement of people to go after, to raise these issues with Israel and to force them into a treaty. But they're a small minority. So I don't know that you have to have somebody call up and say, do this. You have conservative organizations, conservative leadership, basically in a certain sense, pro-NATO, maybe even pro-war leadership in some of these countries. And so they don't need to be told what to do. The only question here is Macron, who keeps writing articles about it and necessary to have French independence.
Okay.
But if it comes down to it, that independence disappears.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joining us from Islamabad. Political commentator Frank M. Spack joining us from Boston. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us here on Spotlight. And, of course, thanks for staying with us on the program.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip: what are the tricks of Shaitan, the Satan, and the soul? And when it comes to our ubudiyya, how do they infiltrate? So, dear listeners, we are talking about the tricks and the delusions and the deceptions of Shaitan and ourself, and how it impacts and affects our ubudiyya, our servitude, our obedience, and our worship to Allah. Now, what is really interesting is that the things which are possible for the common people to do, whether it's in our prayers or our worship or these things, these common things that, for example, for the common people seem to be very simple, such as the salah, the daily prayers, for the people of knowledge, the ahl al-ma'rifah, it actually becomes a delight. It is one of the most satisfying and pleasurable things and actions, the salah, the daily prayers. Now, because these things which to common people seem to be common, such as the du'as and the supplications and the litanies and the different types of worship and obedience and ubudiyya to Allah, in reality these are the secrets and the keys to spiritual wayfaring. Now, when it comes to the spiritual wayfaring, the salik, the spiritual wayfarer who is on this road to ubudiyya, must be very careful that when it comes to their knowledge or when it comes to the different manasik, the different rites and rituals, such as the daily prayers or the du'as that are prescribed by the Ahlul Bayt, when the salik and the spiritual wayfarer is doing these things, they should be very careful that the deceptions and the tricks of Shaitan and the nafs-e ammara do not interfere in these actions that they are doing when it comes to the ubudiyya of Allah. Now, of course, this kind of protection and being careful of the intrusions and the deceptions of Shaitan and the nafs-e ammara, this takes a lot of focus, it takes attention, it takes meditation, it takes time, it takes practice, it takes determination, and it takes, of course, as we said, self-reflection.